Well, the surf's up over at kpft.org. So mouse on over to kpft.org and pledge and renew online. It's easy, uncomplicated, and will give you that warm and fuzzy feeling of having done something good for yourself and your community. So wax that mouse, hang 10, and surf over to kpft.org and renew your membership and pledge online at kpft.org. Thank you for supporting KPFT Houston, Radio for Peace. Mahalo.
Michael, have you come home? You've come to enjoy the Halloween special on So What's Your Story? You say you've gone to the station and found no one. Yes, Michael. Productions are done at home to avoid COVID. Why are you so angry? You fear that KPFT is in trouble? No, not if those who can donate will do so. They simply need to go to www.kpft.org and then to donations, make their payment, and be sure to scroll to So What's Your Story. As a program deserving one's support, make your pledge, Michael, and then die, die, die. Yep, that's my annual and pitiful Dr. Loomis imitation, because Halloween around these parts are fun. But Michael is worried, because So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted to storytelling, is his favorite, even though he likes all the programs on KPFT. But if you know Michael Myers, you know you don't want to make him mad, for all of our sakes. So if you're in a position to donate during our fall fun drive, please do so on kpft.org or our So What's Your Story Facebook page. Our award-winning broadcast celebrates the power of story by placing the spotlight on live tellers who engage us with stirring stories of every genre by taking us on astonishing journeys before returning us safely to the present. And it's a team effort. In fact, I'm talking the best team on radio. I'm Hank Rubicek, host and producer, and along with the likes of Greg Audell, Warren Holloman, Mary Edgerton, Eric Heen, Chrissy Gorman, Harwood Taylor, and Tatiana Gago, we bring you the very best in Houston radio. Our stock in trade is live tellers, but without the station in operation, as Dr. Loomis pointed out, our programs are pre-recorded, often with live tellers pooled with snippets from past shows. Tonight, we get ready for Halloween. Now, I don't have any tricks up my sleeve, but I do have a few treats, starting with a classic written in 1843 by the merciless master of mayhem, Edgar Allan Poe. Now, listen carefully, because this is a 1947 radio version, without the cigarette ads, narrated by James Mason, with its characteristic snap, crackle, and pop in its audio. But this is radio, and we love it. Almost as much as the character proclaiming his sanity as he chops up a little old man in the Telltale Heart.
Think me mad? What madman would wait, could wait so patiently, so long, in the old house, with the old man and the eye that... Then on the eighth night, I knew. Tonight. Still, I waited, while time slowed, stopped, ebbed out. A watch's hand moved more quickly than mine. Then... What? No! For an hour, I did not move a muscle. I could feel the earth turn. The eye... Hear the spider spinning. In the house, the grinding crumble of decay. Then, something else. Dulled and muffled, yet... Of course. It was the beating of the old man's heart. He knew. Such an old man. Louder then. And still louder. For all the world to hear, I know. I had to stop it.
The neighbors reported a scream. We're obliged to investigate.
A scream? My own gentleman. A childish dream. But come in, please. You'll want to look through the house.
That is our duty. Where is the old man?
Gone to the city.
You're up very early this morning.
The dream I spoke of, it awakened me.
When did he leave?
The old man? Yesterday.
How long will he be away?
2 weeks. Perhaps longer.
Nothing out of place here.
There is his bed. Here his cupboard. All in order.
Quite in order.
All quite in order.
Yes, nothing amiss. You understand that when a complaint is made, we have no choice.
Stay, please. Such a wretched hour. I was making tea. A hot drink will break the chill. Surely it would surprise good people how much evil the night conceals from their eyes. But not yours, to be sure. What did you say, sir? Yes, of course, the hot water. It would do no harm to the bare boards. I'm a little less tidy with the old man away. Then I heard it. It might have been a hand, a clock. But no, louder, and still louder. They must hear it. Yet they sit and talk and talk. They must. Of course they do. They know. They do. They're torturing me, watching me, letting it beat so that I...
Stop it! Stop it, you devils! Yes, I did it. It's there, under the floor. Oh, stop it! It is the beating of his hideous heart!
True, I'm nervous. Very, very dreadfully nervous. But why will you say that I'm mad?
Oh yeah, that is old-time radio, in my opinion, at its very best. So 1947, James Mason and the Telltale Heart. To justify murdering someone you like because of his evil eye. A plot that smacks of the evening news, preserving Poe's reputation as creator of the modern detective story. You know, our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, has its share of scary tellers too. Like Brian Herod, who had us hiding under our blankies after telling us this tale.
There once were three boys, and their father and mother were lost in a car accident. And so they were adopted by their uncle, and their uncle treated them very nice. He was always gave them enough to eat and sent them off to school with maybe not the best clothes in the world, but very clean ones, and they were always treated very well. But there was one odd thing about their uncle. Every night before he put them into bed, he would tuck the sheets underneath their chins, and he would tell them. He would say, whatever you hear or whatever you think you see, don't get out of bed. And so the boys would nod their heads rapidly, and he would disappear. But during the night, some nights when they didn't fall asleep immediately, they would hear sounds. Sometimes it was laughing or singing, but always kind of a clicking sound. And they were very, very curious about what it was. So one night after he put them to bed, the oldest boy said to the middle boy, we've got to go see what it is. And the middle boy said, we have to be very, very quiet. And the youngest boy said, I'm scared. And so they creaked open the door, and they walked down the hallway. They peered around the corner, and they didn't see anything. They walked down the hallway a little further, and they went into the kitchen. They peered around the kitchen door. And what should they see in the kitchen? But the room was filled with skeletons. And these skeletons had long wings like a dragonfly behind them, rainbowy, shimmering. And some of the skeletons all wore hats. Some of them had big sombreros, and other ones had small bowler hats. Some of the skeletons were playing cards while others were drinking, and still others were playing the guitar and dancing, and they were all talking to each other and having a good time. The boys were quiet as cats. As they snuck back into their room, they closed the door as silently as they could. When they were in bed, the oldest boy said, what are we going to do? We think that our uncle's a skeleton. And the boy said, let's wait till tomorrow. We'll follow him out and see where he goes and what he does. And the youngest boy said, I'm scared. So they went to school the next day, and they came home, and they had their dinner as they normally did, and they took their bath, got into their PJs, and they went into bed, and their uncle tucked them underneath the covers and looked them in the eye and said those same words to them again. Whatever you hear, or whatever you see, or whatever you think may be going on, don't get out of bed. And they all nodded their heads quickly. And he closed the door behind him. And as soon as the door was closed, the oldest boy said, so we've got to follow him. And the middle boy says, we have to be careful and we have to be quiet. And the youngest boy said, I'm scared. So when they thought that they had heard the front door open up, they opened up their bedroom door. They snuck down the hall. They opened up the front door as quietly as they could. And they saw that in the distance, the sun was going down. And they saw their uncle disappearing into the woods. They crept out across the grass as quietly as they could. They made their way to the woods. And there, they saw into the deepest part their uncle going. And when he got to that middle part of the woods, he said a phrase. He said, skin, skin, come off of me. And just like you might take your clothes off at the end of the day, the man's skin came off of him. And there was a skeleton with those dragonfly wings behind him. And he fluttered the wings, and the skeleton rose through the air, and with a click, clack, click, clack, click, clack, click, clack, he flew through the air. The oldest boy said, our uncle is a skeleton. What are we going to do? And the middle boy said, I have an idea. Let's run back to the house as quickly as we can. And the youngest boy said, I'm scared. And so they made their way back to the house as quickly as they could. And when they got into the kitchen, the oldest boy said, I have an idea. Let's open up the pantry. And the youngest boy said, I think I know what you want to do. And the youngest boy said, I'm scared. And so they opened up the pantry and they got salt and they had pepper and lemon juice out. And they ran back out there to where in the middle of the forest their uncle's skin was. And they took that pepper and they took that salt and they took that lemon juice and they put it upon his skin. And they hid behind a tree for him to come back. And he was gone all night long. And when the sun just started to rise above the trees, they heard that sound again. Click, clack, click, clack, click, clack, click, clack. And they knew their uncle was coming back. They peered around the trees, and what should they see? But they saw that skeleton come back with those diaphanous wings. And the skeleton said, skin, skin, back on me. And the skin rose up, and it rose over his legs, and his waist, and his chest, his arms, and his face. And it was as though when you put on clothes that are wet, it didn't quite fit. And when that last piece of skin came over the skeleton, he called out, my skin, it burns. Skin, skin, off of me. And the skin came down in that puddle just as it was before. And as the sun rose up, the skeleton went click, clack, click, clack, click, clack into the darkest part of the woods. The boys ran back home. They called some relatives. They said that their uncle had gone away, but they didn't tell him any details. And so they went and lived with other relatives. And from that day forward, sometimes in the night, outside their windows, they would hear that sound, click, clack, click, clack, click, clack. And they knew that that was their uncle flying around in the night searching for his skin. And that's a story for you.
You know, it's the plausibility in Brian's stories that kindles the feeling of terror. You know, the I could have, might have, should have. Here's a little true little ditty that I recently came across that I think will make a point. This took place, this is a true story, it took place at a campsite, a summer campsite in Oregon in 1983, and it's entitled The Girl Who Stood on a Grave. Some boys and girls were at a party one night. There was a graveyard down the street, and they were talking about how scary it was. Don't ever stand on a grave after dark, one of the boys said. The person inside will grab you. He'll pull you under. Well, that's not true, one of the girls said. It's just a superstition. Well, I'll give you a dollar if you stand on a grave, said the boy. A grave doesn't scare me, said the girl. I'll do it right now. Well, the boy handed her his knife. Stick this knife in one of the graves, he said, and then we'll know you were there as a sign, a symbol. Well, the graveyard was filled with shadows, and it was as quiet as death. There's nothing to be scared of, the girl told herself, but she was scared anyway. Very scared. She picked out a grave and stood on it. And then quickly, she bent over and plunged the knife into the soil, and she started to leave. But she couldn't get away. Something was holding her back. She tried a second time to leave, but she couldn't move. She was filled with terror. "Something has got me," she screamed, and she fell to the ground. When she didn't come back, the others went to look for her. They found her body sprawled across the grave. Without realizing it, she had plunged the knife through her skirt and had pinned it to the ground. It was only the knife that held her there. She had died of fright. At least, people think she died of fright. Now, this story written by a 10-year-old isn't very plausible, but I think it's pretty cool. Very, very well done. And it's entitled, May I Carry Your Basket? Sam Lewis spent the evening playing chess at his friend's house. It was about midnight when they finished their game, and he started home. Outside, it was icy cold, as quiet as the grave. As he came around a turn on the road, he was surprised to see a woman walking ahead of him. She was carrying a basket covered with a white cloth. When he caught up to her, he looked to see who it was. But she was so bundled up against the cold that it was hard to see her face. "Good evening," Sam said. "What brings you out so late in such cold?" But she didn't answer. Then she said, "May I carry your basket?" And he said, "Well, may I carry yours?" Well, she handed it to him. From under the cloth, a small voice said, "That's very nice of you." And that was followed by wild laughter. Sam was so startled that he dropped the basket, and out rolled a woman's head. He looked at the head, and he stared at the woman. "It's her head," he cried. And he started to run, and the woman and her head began to chase him. "I want to carry your basket," the woman yelled. Soon, the head caught up to him. It bounded into the air and sunk its teeth into his left leg. Sam screamed with pain and ran even faster, but he hobbled most of the way. But the woman and her head stayed right behind. Soon, the head leaped into the air again and bit into his other leg. Now, Sam was so injured, he couldn't move. He was hobbling. And the woman cried and then laughed and then cried again and said, "Oh, you poor thing. You can't walk." And put Sam in the basket and said, "Now, I can carry the basket with you, since you can't walk." And they were both gone. That's my Target little toy. Never go out of the house on Halloween without it. Peggy and I visited 2 years ago Gettysburg, and that night my paranormal skeptic wife looked over to me with a blank stare in this little hotel in Gettysburg, and she said, "Look at this." It was on her phone. It was a photo of a woman, or a tracing of a woman, transparent, colorless, looking in the front window of the Jenny Wade House, considered one of the most haunted venues in the nation. We had it verified, and it is a ghost. In fact, one expert saw two. See for yourself, because I put it on our Facebook page. Well, after that event, we began watching programs about the paranormal on the Travel Channel. Paranormal Lockdown, The Dead Files, Ghost Adventures, and so on. And then, a little over a year ago, the team from Ghost Hunters, another reputable program, were strolling in our neighborhood. Turns out they were examining a house around the corner. The story was on their show, and I assure you the owner was articulate, cogent, sane, and terrified. Every morning at precisely 2 a.m., the resident was awakened by a smoky, insidious figure of a man appearing at her front door, hard to miss in a small bungalow of roughly 1,000 square feet. She would stand at the entrance of her bedroom, frozen, when the figure rushed toward her, stopping just inches before reaching her. She was petrified, motionless. Ghost hunters boarded in the house and, with frightening precision, confronted the sinister apparition just like our lucid occupant. Upon investigation, the hunters discovered a bloody historical past on the grounds where the house was built. Military training sessions and centers were once peppered in the vicinity, and a soldier, very much in love with a young woman, learned of her affair while he was in combat. Maddened, the day he returned from war, he broke down the front door, of course, you guessed it, at 2 a.m., and brutally murdered them both. A team of exorcists excised his spirit. All of this right around the corner. Houston has no shortage of haunts. These are widely considered to be the five creepiest. Spaghetti Warehouse was the pharmaceutical warehouse, and the story begins with a young pharmacist accidentally falling into an open elevator shaft, falling several feet to his death. His wife, traumatized by grief, died about a year later. It's said that these grief-stricken lost souls, especially the wife, haunts the restaurant. The Rice Hotel is where JFK spent his last night before being assassinated in November 1963. Cold spots, rattling doors and beds, orbs of light and presence are felt in the JFK room. Ghost dancers appeared in the ballroom before it was renovated into the Rice Lofts. Now, the lofts are haunted by spirits who dance on the rooftops. Up on the roof. The Glenwood Cemetery on Washington is the final resting place of many influential Houstonians, including Howard Hughes. The manicured tree-shaded lawn appears serene, but appearances can be deceiving. There's an unsolved murder of the owner of the cemetery, which inspires his spirit to roam aimlessly on the grounds. Named after the president of the Confederacy, the Jeff Davis Hospital, now the Elder Street Artist Lofts, is another famous location explored by paranormal investigators. It was erected in 1924 atop what was a Confederate cemetery, and before that, a burial site for plague victims. Screams and howls have been heard throughout the building, and shadowy figures have been caught on film. Downtown wine and dive bar La Carafe is believed to be the oldest bar in Houston. Built in 1866, the building is most notably haunted by a former bartender named Carl. Employees have reported hearing footsteps, glass breaking, the sound of heavy objects moving around the vacant second floor, and cold spots in the restrooms. Carl has been spotted standing on the second floor vacancy in the window after closing time. The brewery, the Alley Theater, Battleship Texas, and the Hotel Galvez add to an impressive list of haunts. Locations here in Houston, not for the faint of heart. But you know, the scariest place is wherever you are when tuning into KPFT and hear, that's right, silence. Because a serious lack of funding makes it impossible to bring you the eclectic programming that you've come to expect. Even in these turbulent times on this Pacifica affiliate, we are listener-sponsored, plain and simple, and we need you. Our So What's Your Story team knows that donating isn't possible for many of you. That's okay. Better times ahead will make that more likely, so I'm reaching out to those of you who can comfortably donate, and if you are in that group, please go to kpft.org or our Facebook page to make your pledge. But whether you are or not able to help us financially, we need you to make us a weekly routine, because this program was designed for you, our community of the best folks on the planet whose stories, told or not, have made us better. Our tone has always been of great storytellers. And you know what? Our town has always been a center for storytellers. And it all starts with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, because it's a great place to learn about the art of telling. They meet the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. When we return to our face-to-face world, the Guild holds its swap at Temple Emmanuel, located at 1500 Sunset. But for now, we're having a ton of folks from all over the country zooming in and having a ball. The next swap is Tuesday, October 27th. Visit the Guild's website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for the Zoom link and for information about all our upcoming events, including dates and times for Skyline Screamers on Saturday, October 24th from 7 to 9 p.m. at social distancing friendly Marmion Park at 1800 Heights Boulevard. While you're on the site, enjoy our past So What's Your Story programs, all of them since 2008, listed on the menu under radio program. There is no need for a radio when you're tuning in every week to our award-winning program, because you can listen to a stream online, live, on kpft.org. Get to know us by visiting our So What's Your Story Facebook page, and be sure to share it with friends. And you know what? We'd love it if you'd like us when you leave. If you have any program ideas, guests, maybe even yourself, let us know by dropping us a note at story@kpft.org, and we promise to get back to you. Our friends at the Moth may not be packing into Warehouse Live lately, but you can catch them online, including nationwide story slams that you're going to love. In fact, our dear friend Eric Heen, who hosted last week, won the Central Grand Slam award a couple weeks ago. My God, he was great. He was so terrific. And for anyone wanting to take their storytelling skills to the next level, why not become a member of Tejas Storytelling Association and the National Storytelling Network? This is Hank Rubicek, and you are listening to Scary Stuff on So What's Your Story, only on Pacifica 90.1 Houston and 91.9 for our friends in Huntsville. A little earlier, I was mentioning Texas haunts, but there's a longer list of outstanding Texas storytellers. One such teller with a list of accolades longer than you can measure is Jerry Young, whose festival performances are legendary. But it's his ghost stories you don't want to do without this time of year. Got a couple that you're going to want to love to listen to. You're going to want to hold on to these in your mind. They're called The Mysterious Woman of Lincoln and Prom Night. Want you to keep a light on and enjoy.
Lineville Creek meanders down between Matagorda and Brazoria County on its way to the Mexican Gulf. A vast wilderness straddles both sides of the creek. To local folks, this is known as Lineville Bottom. Now, the black bear prowls in the bottom. Tracks of deer, night hare, and a wildcat can be found in its muddy flats. The howls of wolves, the screams of panther echo through the vast wilderness. The creek winds down through the bottom, creating sloughs and bayous. At night, bull gators bellow and slap their tails on the muddy green waters. Now, the bottom has never been settled. There are old roads that run through it, but they are abandoned and overchoked with weeds and crooked at its old sinner's life. And here and there through the bottom are remnants of failed lives. Clearings that once were fields of sweet potatoes or corn are now choked with weeds. Old rail fences are pulled down by the brambles and the briars. And old log cabins rot with their chimneys tumbled in. And doors hang from rusty hinges, creak and moan in the wind like the voices of the long distant past dead. Now the bottom is dark and dismal as it was when the first man wandered lost among its creeks and sloughs. And those exhausted, terrified souls fell among the brambles and the bamboo, the muscadine, beneath their old, ageless limbs hanging with moss. And there in the melancholy darkness, the beetles and the scorpions and the centipedes crawled in and out of the white bones of these tormented souls. Now in June of 1926, a black touring car stopped at a garage in Angleton. Two young men sat in the front seat dressed in white suits and touring caps. In the back seat sat a beautiful young lady with auburn hair, poised and regal. She wore a white summery dress and a pair of white patent leather shoes. The men asked directions into the bottom, explaining they were on a hunting and fishing trip. And 2 or 3 days later, the black touring car drove out of the bottom and stopped at the same garage. Folks down there in Angleton still debate whether the woman in the white dress and auburn hair sat in the back seat or not. Now, the Brownsville Railroad runs through the lower part of the bottom, and some of the Mexican section hands live in section houses with their families there beside the tracks. One morning, Maria Gonzalez went out to pick up some lumps of coal for her stove. She hadn't gone far up the tracks before she saw a young lady standing right at the edge of that line between the blackness of the bottom and the light of the cut. Maria noticed that the lady might have had red or auburn hair at one time, but now it was all wet and tangled. Maria saw that her white dress was snagged and torn and smattered with mud, and she wore one white mud-covered shoe. Maria called out to the young lady, "Hola!" The lady seemed not to understand or to hear. Maria called out again, "Señora, hola!" The young lady turned towards Maria's voice, and she extended a hand, then she pulled it back to cover her mouth like she was stifling a scream, and she looked up the tracks, and the young lady dashed back into the darkness of the bottom. Maria looked up the tracks to see what had frightened the young woman. Two section hands walking down the cut, their heavy boots crunching on the gravel. The section foreman reported the mysterious woman to the sheriffs of Brazoria and Matagorda counties. The sheriff sent a posse into the bottom to search for the woman. For 3 days, men on horseback searched throughout the wilderness. They found the tracks of a car had gone back about 3 miles into the bottom, and they found where someone had camped. They found pieces of white material snagged on the briars, and they found one white mud-covered shoe. One of the searchers reported finding a bloody footprint where someone had crossed a creek. But the men saw no sign of this mysterious woman. In the days that followed, some of the section hands reported seeing the young woman running through the forest like a demented angel. And at night, the section hands sat at the supper table with their families, and they could hear the curses and the cries of the woman echoing throughout the wilderness and vast emptiness. She cursed the men who had abandoned her, and she cried for her mother. Then, after 3 days, the Lineville bottom returned to its primordial silence. No more cries, no more curses. And the mysterious woman with the auburn hair was seen no more. People around the counties used to ask, who was this woman? Why was she deserted in the bottom? Now, their gossip speculated that she was a rich heiress from Houston that had been abandoned in the bottom for her money. Others championed the theory that she was an unfaithful lover who had been deserted in the bottom as revenge for her unfaithfulness. But who she was and what had brought her to this dismal place, nobody knew. And so, there in the bottom, deserted and alone, facing dangers too horrible to mention, No food, no light, no companion. Hearing the howls of wolves and the screams of panthers and the belling of bull gators and the wind wailing like demented demons. Reason left the mystery woman of Lineville Bottom. The sheriffs of Brazoria and Matagorda County sent a posse into the bottom one last time to search for the young woman. But there was no sign of the mysterious woman with the auburn hair. And so down in the vast wilderness that straddles Lineville Creek, where the black bear prowls, where wolves howl and panther screams and gators bellow at night, this terrified, exhausted woman fell among the brambles and the bamboos and the muscadine, between the giant trees with mossy limbs. And there, in the melancholy darkness of the bottom, the beetles and the scorpions and the centipedes crawl in and out of the white bones of the mystery woman of Lineville Bottom. The white jackets of the rented tuxedo lay sprawled across the back seat of Jeb Ryder's 56 blue and white Chevrolet Impala. Elvis Presley sang Love Me Tender from the radio, with collars open and ties undone. Jeb and Josh Rainier sang backup at full volume. A light rain spattered the windshield as Jeb drove home to Gatlin, Texas. Riding shotgun, Josh rolled down the window, stuck his torso outside, and howled at the rain. The two friends knew that this was the best night of their whole lives. They had just come from the best prom in the history of Gatlin, Texas. They knew their dates were the prettiest girls at the dance, and in 3 days they would graduate. Driving home was like cooling down after a football practice. The light rain became a steady downpour as the Impala approached that long sweeping curve into Hickory Creek Bridge. Jeb turned the windshield wipers on full speed, and he lit up on the gas pedal. Impala's headlights glared in the sheeting rain. Jeb and Josh stopped singing as they peered through the sweep of the windshield wipers. Then, as the Impala approached Hickory Creek Bridge, the glare of the headlights framed a frail blonde girl dressed in off-the-shoulder blue formal, standing right at the edge of the road next to the bridge. She waved her hand like she wanted to ride. Jeb gripped the steering wheel as he broke to a stop. The girl's sudden appearance startled the boys, and it took them a few minutes to catch their wits. Through the sweep of the windshield wipers, Jeb and Josh saw that the girl was about their ages. Her hair streamed down around her shoulders, and her blue dress was soaked like she'd been standing in the rain a long time. She appeared to be dressed like she had been to the prom, but the boys thought the girl's blue formal dress looked like one that the girl's mother might have worn when she went to the prom. A single white gardenia corsage was pinned to the dress. Well, maybe she had been to the prom, but the boys didn't remember seeing her there. Jeb rolled down his window and called the girl, "Hurry up, get in." Josh reached over the back seat and opened the back door. But the girl didn't move. She just stood there, her shoulders hunched against the rain. Jeb and Josh jumped from the Impala and hustled the girl into the back seat. With the dome light on, they got a better look at her. Mud stained her dress, and there were scratches and bruises on her face, on her neck. Jeb and Josh saw her shivering, and they put their tuxedo jackets around her. "Are you all right? How'd you get here?" Jeb asked. "I want to go home," the girl said in a colorless, flat voice. The girl's voice was so soft that the boys weren't sure she'd said anything. "Were you at the prom?" asked Josh. "Where's your date?" "I want to go home," the girl said again. "How did you get those cuts and bruises on your face?" Jeb asked her. The girl didn't say anything. She just sat, looked straight ahead. She didn't seem to see Josh or Jeb, either one. Josh tried one more time. What's your name? I'm Josh, and this is Jeb. I want to go home, the girl whispered once again. Jeb and Josh looked at each other, puzzled. Well, sure, we'll take you home. Where do you live? Jeb asked her. 613 Poplar Street, she said. Now, Gatlin, Texas is not a big town, but the boys weren't sure they knew where Poplar Street was. By the time the Impala passed Forney's service station and hamburger shack on the edge of town, the rain had stopped. Josh turned to look at the girl in the back seat, and she hadn't moved. Her eyes stared straight ahead without blinking. You okay? Josh asked softly. I want to go home, the girl whispered in the same strange, flat voice. Josh turned back to the front, and he and Jeb looked at each other, and they shrugged their shoulders. The Impala cruised along Main Street. The stores were dark and closed. The street lamps cast white shadows on the wet, oily asphalt. The single stoplight at the intersection of Main and Broadway flashed red in all four directions. Jeb slowed the car and stopped at the red light, then slowly accelerated again. They drove in silence for two or three blocks. It was like the rain had washed away all the noises. Jeb asked, where is Poplar Street? Josh turned towards the back seat for the girl's answer. Well, she's not here, he yelped. What, said Jeb, and he braked to the Impala to a stop. She's not here, Josh repeated. Jeb turned in his seat. Well, where did she go, he asked. I didn't hear her get out of the car. Well, maybe she got out when we stopped at the stoplight. Can't be, said Jeb. We would have heard the car door shut. Jeb whipped the car around in the middle of the street. They patrolled up and down Main Street, and they drove up and down Broadway. They searched for the girl back and forth, and there's no signs of her. It was as if she never existed. Well, now what'll we do, Josh asked. I don't know, said Jeb. Maybe we should find her parents and tell them. What, do you know where Poplar Street is? Jeb said, I think it's over on the east side of town. Jeb turned the car and headed into the oldest part of Gatlin. The houses were run down and unpainted, sagging roofs and porches. Yards were cluttered with trash and junk cars rusted in the street. Even with spring coming on, the trees were lifeless. Instead of making things fresh, the rain only made the neighborhood black and water-soaked. The boys drove through the streets, and in the glare of the headlights, they tried to read the street signs. Josh suddenly called, there it is, Poplar Street. Then he called off the numbers of the as Jeb eased a car along the street. 400, 500, 601, 607, 611, there it is, 613. Jeb stopped the car in front of an old two-story house. Looked like all the other houses on the block, run down and unpainted. A rusty iron fence enclosed a yard filled with junk and winter brown zinnias. The boys got out of the car, and rusty hinges croaked loudly as they opened the iron gate. They looked at each other for courage before they walked up the sidewalk to the front door of the dark house. Jeb knocked on the door, and no one came. Well, maybe you ought to knock on the glass, suggested Josh. Jeb pulled open the screen door and rapped on the glass. A light came on in the back of the house. A moment later, the window and the door lighted up as a light was turned on. The shade covering the window fluttered, and one eye peered out at the boys. A woman's voice said, what do you boys want at this time of night? Josh said, I'm Josh Rainier, and this is Jeb Ryder. We just gave a ride to a girl, and she said she lived here. The window shade fluttered again, and the eye disappeared. The boys heard a skeleton key rattling in the lock, and the door opened halfway, like the person behind it wasn't sure she should open it any farther. The lady framed in the half-open door had gray, wiry hair and gray eyes. A limp, worn, once pink chenille bathrobe covered her nightgown. What did you say? There was a bit of alarm in the woman's voice. We found this girl standing beside the road near Hickory Creek Bridge, explained Jeb. The rain was pouring down, and we got her in the car. She was shivering all over, and we put our jackets around her to warm her up. Josh added, all she said was, I want to go home, and she gave us this address. But when we got to town, she wasn't in the car, explained Jeb. We drove around looking for her, but we didn't find her. We don't know what happened to her. The woman listened carefully. Then she pulled the door open and pushed the screen door open. Come in, she said. Once the boys were seated in an old gray sofa, the woman said, this girl, you found her standing beside Hickory Creek Bridge? Is that right? Yes, ma'am, said Jeb. And she had blonde hair. And she wore an off-the-shoulder blue formal with a white gardenia corsage. The boys looked at each other amazed. But yes, ma'am, said Jeb. And her face had cuts and bruises on it, the woman continued. Yes, Josh said. How did you know? The girl's name is Earlene, the woman said. She was my daughter. 20 years ago, she went to the prom. On the way home, it was raining a downpour. Her date's car skidded off the road at Hickory Creek Bridge. I was told her last words were, I want to go home.
Texas folk teller Jerry Young with Woman of Linville and Prom Night. Prom Night is always a scary night, isn't it? Always a scary story. Check this out. It's called An Old Woman All Skin and Bone. There was an old woman all skin and bone who lived near the graveyard all alone. Ooh, she thought she'd go to church one day to hear the parson preach and pray. Ooh. And when she came to the church house stile, she thought she'd stop and rest a while. Oh, when she came up to the door, she thought she'd stop and rest some more. Ooh, but when she turned and looked around, she saw a corpse upon the ground. Ooh, from its nose down to its chin, the worms crawled out and the worms crawled in. Oh, the woman to the preacher said, shall I look like this when I am dead? Oh, the preacher to the woman said, you look like that when you are dead. I think I'm losing batteries on this like 12-year-old Target toy, but I love it. Love that little sound effect. You know, but I just turned 10, so what are you going to do, right? What are you going to do? I do hope that you are enjoying this little bit of a haunted night on So What's Your Story, only on KPFT 90.1 Houston. This is Hank Rubicek, and I am awfully glad that you are here. You know, our fall fun drive is nearing to an end, but you can always donate online, always donate online anytime to let KPFT know that our programming matters to you. This program has been on for about 12 years. I'd like to think it's a Houston institution. And God willing, we'll be on another 12 years because storytelling connects by allowing us to visit each other through windows of our souls. So, it's important to know that storytelling rules and it rocks our world, and it should. It's been around forever, and it's a way of documenting and validating our life and realizing that the greatest common denominator is vulnerability. You know, it's really tough to imagine anything remotely close to a typical Halloween this year, but for the sake of our youngins and youngins at heart, please be sure to look for creative ways to celebrate. Because when witches go riding and black cats are seen, the moon laughs and whispers, 'Tis near Halloween. We're going to be changing up our outro, just like our intro, with a semi-Halloween-y rock tune. Released 1978, Warren Zevon, Werewolves of London. Don't you dare move, because Lars and the Tennyson Tape Deck is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story and Treasure What You Hear. You keep loving a great story, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. This is Hank Rubicek, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
If you can hop around your kitchen door, better not let him in. Little old lady got mutilated late last night. Werewolves of London again. Mucking kids. Lately he's been overheard in Mayfair. Better stay away from him. He'll rip your lungs out, Jim. I'd like to meet his tape. Werewolves of London. Jenny walking with a queen, doing the werewolves of London. I saw Lon Chaney Jr. walking with a queen, doing the werewolves of London. I saw a werewolf drinking a pina colada at Trader Vic's. His hair was perfect.
Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, host of The Attitude, heard wicked early on KPFT 90.1 FM. I originate on a little community radio station, WNHN-FM in Concord, New Hampshire. But like our big brother, KPFT, this definition of community radio ties us together. Quote, it should be made clear that community radio is not about doing something for the community, but about the community doing something for itself. In other words, owning and controlling its own means of communication. Close quote. I love this definition from AMARC Africa. So, folks, if you care about your community, you can show it by caring for KPFT 90.1 FM. Thanks for making The Attitude with Arnie Arneson part of the KPFT political talk. We love sharing the heat and the light.
Big and bright, yeah, yeah. Deep in the heart of Texas.
If you have friends in other cities who wish they had access to some of the great programming you hear on this station and the Pacifica Radio Network, we have a website for you.
PacificaNetwork.org gives community radio stations like this one complete information on how to become a Pacifica affiliate and information for listeners looking for community radio stations that air Pacifica programming.
With the launch of PacificaNetwork.org, Pacifica Radio is bringing together frequently requested items regarding Pacifica as a network.
Nearly 100 radio stations.
Homes.
From Carbondale, Colorado to Benwood, West Virginia.
From Bend, Oregon to Hobbs Ferry, New York.
From Moscow, Idaho to Chicago, Illinois.
Have all made a statement by linking up and carrying Pacifica Radio programming.
So tell your far-flung friends about PacificaNetwork.org to connect communities.
This is Pacifica Radio, KPFT, Houston.
Did you know that you can double your